WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
Nuruddin Farah is the best-known novelist from his country, Somalia. In 1974, the regime of Siad Barre condemned Farah's second novel, A Naked Needle, banned his work, and ordered his death. Farah fled the country and now lives in South Africa. He first returned to Somalia in 1996 and, as we'll hear, was taken hostage there. His most recent trip was at the end of 2006 when he was asked to help open communications between warring factions and was nearly killed along the way. Somalia has been in chaos since 1991 when warlords overthrew Barre and turned against each other. In 2004, a transitional government made up in part of former warlords was formed with the help of the UN and backed by the US. Last year, Islamists took over much of southern Somalia and the capital city, Mogadishu. They were pushed back with the help of Ethiopia's military, but for the past month, the Islamic movement has been attacking Mogadishu daily. Nuruddin Farah's novels have dealt with the chaos in his country. His new novel, Knots, is about a woman who was born in Somalia but grew up in North America. After her marriage falls apart, she returns to Somalia, where her family home has been taken over by warlords. She finds that women in Somalia are now always in danger of being attacked and raped by the young men in the militias. Women in Somalia now have to cover themselves when in public.
Women have to cover themselves up in public for two or three major reasons. One of them is, first of all, they do not want to be seen as such. And the reason is because being seen means that you attract the attention of a militiaman. The other thing is Somalia has now become more conservative in terms of Islam, more of late, in fact, in the past 20 years, the Islamic variety from Saudi Arabia, the Wahhabism, seems to have entered into the consciousness of the Somali more than before, so that Somalis who used to wear certain form of dresses that didn't necessarily cover every part of their bodies, the Somali national dress, the guntino, in fact allows the woman's body to be seen. Even though it's covered, you could, well, I mean, you don't need to imagine what it is, because you can see the breasts or side of the breast, or you could see the woman's body. And I remember in the 70s and early 80s, more and more of the Arabs, whether they were Saudis or Egyptians or even Libyans, insisting that Somalis were not Muslims anymore. But since the famine of the mid-1970s, and since Somalia has become more and more reliant on food aid, on aid from the petrodollar Arab countries, Somalis have begun to emulate the ways of the Saudis, the ways of the desert Arabs, and more and more women have started covering themselves to an extent where you don't actually see any part of their body except their eyes.
Yeah, it seems that for women in Somalia now, in some ways, at least from a Western woman's perspective, it's the worst of both worlds. You have to cover yourself when you're in public, but at the same time, you're subjected to harassment, physical attacks, and rape by all these militias.
Exactly. And to top it all, the responsibility of holding the family together falls on the Somali women. And the reason is because men have become uselessly involved in politics, talking, without actually doing any work, any serious work.
When the main character in your novel returns to Somalia, she keeps her eyes downcast, as women must do when they're in public, but she also carries a knife under her body veil. Have you met women who do that in Somalia?
I must confess that I haven't, but I have spoken to one or two young Somali women who are dressed in that manner. And I asked them very discreetly whether or not they were carrying anything hidden And they said they carry hidden things. I mean, one of them was carrying one of those sprays that she took from America. And I met another one who, you know.
A spray? You mean like mace or something?
I suppose so, yes. Mm-hmm. Yes, yes. And she says, because if you get very close to a woman with the intention of raping, one of the ways that she could protect herself was to use the spray into the, you know, spray it into the eyes or something.
When your main character returns to Mogadishu, she also finds her family home has been taken over by a minor warlord. Is there somebody in particular you've based this warlord on?
Well, I would say that I think there are many minor warlords, and the way they behave is typical of warlords who naturally what they do is they run control points of certain parts of the city, and they somehow raise funds for their fighters by stopping people and robbing them, and you know, by levying tax on motor vehicles that are going from one point of the city to the other. And so I would say that although it wasn't one particular minor warlord, there are many minor warlords whom I have met. I've also interviewed almost all the major warlords, with the exception of General Idid, who died before I got to him in the end.
So you've interviewed a lot of warlords, but I wonder if you've had contact, less journalistic contact with warlords. I wonder if warlords have stopped you, harassed you, hit you up for bribes, the kind of standard things that warlords do to people.
Well, when I returned to Somalia after 22-year absence and returned to the city called Kismayo, which is in the southeast of Somalia, and I was taken hostage and kept hostage in a small little room, a cubicle, for about 4 or 5 days. And therefore, I wasn't tortured, but I wasn't allowed the freedom that I needed to go around the city of Kismayo. And I was somehow, you know, word got out, and, you know, there was an article about it in the London Guardian, and was allowed to leave after negotiations between friends of one of my brothers and the warlord concerned. Since then, I have been more and more cautious, so that whenever I go back to Somalia, I arrange some kind of protection, because there are systems of protection that one can put in place. And that's what I've done. I was in Somalia as recently as a couple of months ago. This time, attempting to broker peace between the federal government that's now set up and the then Islamists who ran and ruled much of southern Somalia.
When you were taken hostage, did they take you because they knew who you were? Did they take you because you were a high-profile hostage? Were they hoping to get a lot of money in return for your release?
I think they knew who I was, but they didn't know what to do with me once they got me. And the reason is because I simply said that I wasn't willing. The warlord wanted me to carry a message to the international press and to praise him and say that he was a savior of the city, because he had just taken the city then. But I wasn't willing to do that. And the reason is because I said I wasn't going to be able to carry his message until I was free to do so. And the only way I could do so, I told him, was to be able to return to Nairobi from whence I came, so that, you know, I could talk to the press. And naturally, in the end, I didn't have to, because he realized that I wasn't the kind of person who could be bullied into doing whatever he decided that I would do.
So who is controlling Somalia now?
Now it seems the federal government controls much of the territory.
And now is the federal government Islamist?
No, the federal government is secularist.
Secularist?
Yeah. And now the Islamists are on the run. Some of them are on the run. Some of those people who are running the show in Mogadishu at the time are on the run.
And are the warlords still out of control, or are they coming back in control now that the Islamists
no, the
are on
the
run?
No, the warlords have been sidelined. This is my understanding. I haven't been to Mogadishu for the past 5-6 weeks, and so I don't actually know. But from what I hear, the warlords have been sidelined. Their militiamen have been disarmed, demobilized, and some of the militiamen are being trained to form part of the National Army.
So now that the Islamists are out of power and the warlords are out, women still have to cover themselves in public?
I don't think that they will continue to do so in the coming few months. I think women will be coming out of their, well, veiled cocoons, if that's one can put it. And the reason is because they were covering themselves for two major reasons. One is, as I said to you, because they were afraid of being, you know, attracting attention from the potential rapists and militiamen. And secondly, because the Islamists were in control of much of southern Somalia. I am hoping and I am thinking that probably we would return gradually to the usual traditional way, Somali way of dressing, which is much more, well, more relaxed, let's say, more tolerant of a woman showing, well, her natural body.
You've been living in exile, and you were not allowed to return to Somalia for many years, but you did return for the first time. Was it 1996? That was the first time you went back?
Yes, indeed, yes.
And I'm wondering, you know, one of the advantages of anarchy is that there isn't a repressive state government to prevent dissidents like you from returning home. So in a way, was it anarchy that made it possible for you to go back?
Well, it was in part anarchy. It was also in part because the president of the country who sentenced me to death earlier had been thrown out of power. And therefore, you know, I hadn't, or rather, I haven't up to now upset anyone enough for me to feel threatened again. It's very possible that someone may not like, for example, not the novel, and therefore, you know, it's possible that that future governments may not see things the way I see them, especially if I criticize the way they run the show.
My guest is novelist Nuruddin Farah. His new book is called Knots. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is novelist Nuruddin Farah. He's from Somalia, but fled his country after the government banned his work and ordered his death in the 70s. He's made several trips back since 1996. You know, you were telling us before that you tried to broker some kind of agreement or at least open up channels of communication between the warlords and the Islamists who were fighting for control.
Between the federal government and the Islamists, yes. The president of the Federal Republic, yeah.
You're a novelist. Did you ever think that this would be one of your functions?
No, no. The idea never crossed my mind. It was put into my mind, it was put into my head, I should say, by the person who called me, the Islamist who called me, and said, we would like you to do this because we respect your opinion. We know that you are a secularist. I mean, he obviously said that probably you and I are not going to agree on many things, but what we want to agree on is peace for Somalia.
And you said yes.
And I said yes. I took it as a challenge. And then paid my way to Nairobi and then Mogadishu. And, you know, ran, you know, into some trouble myself. Nearly got killed for my pains. I mean, I had a gun put to my head when
By who?
By, you know, at that time, it's no longer so. But at that time, between Baidawa, which is 350 kilometers to the west of Mogadishu and Mogadishu itself, there was a no man's land in which militiamen from the clan families in that area operated. The federal government was isolated in a small town. Mogadishu was 350 kilometers away, and therefore between Mogadishu and the federal government, between the reach of the Islamists, let's say, which is 60 kilometers before Baidoa, there were militiamen who were as wild as you can ever imagine anyone. And the taxi that I was driving in was stopped, and a gun was put to my head because somebody assumed that I must be, rich enough to pay him $4 or $5. And he insisted that I should get out of the car, empty my pockets, and give him the money that he was asking for. And if I didn't do that, he was going to shoot me.
Did you do it?
I didn't.
You didn't?
I didn't, because I consulted the driver. You see, because there is always, in civil wars, there are always codes of behavior. I didn't want to alienate myself, first of all, from the taxi driver, because my life was in his hands. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't do anything without consulting him. And so I looked at him, and he said to me not to pay a cent. And so I said, you negotiate with him. And then there was an argument between the taxi driver and the militiamen. And there were 20 or 30 of them, some of them sitting on the bonnet of the car, some of them on the roof of the car, making all kinds of noises. All this time, a gun put to my head. And I refused to give in, because I knew that sooner or later, after negotiations, once the negotiations start, no one is going to shoot you quite easily. I was only worried that he might accidentally pull the trigger. And I kept saying to myself, well, you know, I've written enough novels to last me, or last anyone who wanted to read some of these novels, and I'm not going to panic or give in. And the negotiations went on for no less than, 15, 20 minutes, until finally it was agreed that the man, the taxi driver, would pay him when he got back, because this taxi driver plied between Baidoa, where we came from, and Mogadishu.
Do you know whatever happened?
I have no idea.
Right.
I gave some money to the taxi driver.
So that the taxi driver could later pay
the
militia?
Yes, I hoped he would, but I doubt very much if he did.
Who knows if he's still alive? Well, can you imagine driving a taxi in conditions like that?
I think I would have heard if he had died.
Good. Okay. Do you see yourself in a way in situations like that as if you were a soldier, like willing to give your life for your country?
I wasn't actually thinking about that, I'll be honest with you. I was just thinking, I said to myself, would I be able to finish the third part of the trilogy? I nearly, I would have asked him if he had allowed me to speak. I would have said to him, will I be able to, let me finish the third part of the trilogy, then you can come and shoot me if you must.
Can you pretty well assume that the militia guys who had the gun to your head and were negotiating for the $4, that, like, they don't read?
No, they don't. They don't. They don't. And as a matter of fact, this is one of the reasons why I'm interested and have been interested and will continue to be interested in Somalia, is the fact, the educational structures have totally collapsed, and especially the secularist form of education. And one of the things that I have been, I've been trying to interest both donor countries as well as the president of the federal government and even the Islamists when I talk to them, with the reopening of the secular school systems, mm-hmm. so that people could have the possibility of going back to a secular education system where, if they wish, obviously they could go, to a Quranic school. But in addition to that, I was thinking that the schools must reopen, because Somalia had a secular education system, and Somali used to be the language in which everything was taught from primary school through university in Somali, much of it, and in some European languages. And it's no longer so. And therefore, my interest in returning to Somalia, and whenever I've returned to Somalia, even when the warlords were in control, was to go to universities and schools and talk about secular education and the resumption of that responsibility by the state.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us. And I, you know, congratulations on your new book. And I look forward to the publication of the third book in your trilogy, and I hope you can take your time in writing it.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you so much for talking with us. Nuruddin Farah's new novel is called Knots.